Okay, so the Biennio Rosso, or Two Red Years in Italy from 1919 to 1920, were a key link in the chain of revolutionary upheavals which swept Europe after the Russian Revolution of 1917. A mass movement of workers in Italy's industrial north occupied their factories and attempted to launch decisive struggles against the capitalist class and their state. In the south, land occupations by peasants disturbed centuries-old social relations. So in Italy, like a lot of other European countries in this period, the radical conjuncture created by the war and the social upheaval that was generated by it gave Marxists an unprecedented opportunity to relate their theory of revolution to working class practice. And obviously the largest leap that was taken in this period was the October Revolution in Russia of 1917. This is when workers seized state power for the first time. And October clarified the political form that workers' power would take. The Soviet in Russia, a form of council democracy based on the mass organizations of the working class. The workers' councils in Russia showed how to smash the alienated and bureaucratic apparatus of the capitalist state and engage the majority of the population directly in the administration of society. So that was the highest form, I think, still today, of democracy we've seen in the world so far. Trotsky's founding manifesto of the Communist International made it clear that the Soviets in Russia were not just a peculiar Russian innovation, but had universal relevance and applicability. So he wrote in that manifesto, to strengthen the Soviets, to raise their authority, to counterpose them to the state apparatus of the bourgeoisie. This is today the most important task of the class-conscious and honest workers of all countries. Through the medium of the Soviets, the working class will be able to come to power the most surely and easily. And this feeling, it's worth saying, as well, was not just confined to organized communists. There was a British government report from 1918 that spoke of the very widespread feeling amongst workers that thrones had become anachronisms and that the Soviet may be the best form of government for a democracy. But moving beyond these sorts of pronouncements to the difficult task of assimilating the lessons of the Russian Revolution was a challenge. And harder still, I think, was applying those insights to countries and conditions in Western Europe with their large parliamentary workers' parties and trade union bureaucracies. That includes Italy, of course. So that task put all the sections of the Italian left to the test. So that's really what I'm going to be focusing on in this introduction. If you want a broader narrative history, you can read my articles. But I'm going to focus on the debate surrounding the councils in Italy, the attempts to build workers' power. I think understanding how these situations of dual power can emerge and how revolutionaries can intervene to advance and accelerate that process is obviously a key lesson we can glean from our movement's history. And those sorts of questions have been posed time and time again at high points of radical upheaval, from Germany in 1918, Chile in 1973, Iran in 1979, Bolivia in the early 2000s, and the list just goes on and on. So just firstly, to set the scene for what Italy looked like in this period, the movement for factory councils in Italy, I think, was a product of the profound radicalization that was generated by the First World War, which shook the unstable social structure of Italy to its core. So at the front, 615,000 Italians were killed, 500,000 people were disabled, more than 1 million were wounded. Peasant conscript soldiers largely were forced to risk their lives, you know, fighting over scraps of territory somewhere over the other end of the country that they'd never even heard of. And they returned back from the war to Italy, profoundly radicalized. The war also savaged working class living standards as well. So in Turin, it was estimated that consumption of meat fell by a third and sugar by half. There were chronic food shortages in all the major cities in the period of the war and the post-war period. From very early on in Italy, there was widespread opposition to the war. This was largely produced by the kind of anti-militarist traditions of the Italian workers' movement. So there were monumental riots and strikes that shook the country in August of 1914 and June of 1917, which could only be ended after massive bloodshed. As in the rest of Europe as well, war production, the need to produce for the war effort, massively intensified the oppression that workers faced at the point of production. So in Italy, committees for industrial mobilization, they were called, were set up, which basically instituted martial law in the factories. Workers were tied to their jobs under threat of imprisonment or deployment to the trenches. Strikes were outlawed, and all disputes had to be arbitrated through those mobilization committees. Importantly, and this is going to be a key part of the dynamics of the struggle, the leaders of the FIOM, which was the Metal Workers Union, which represented the vast majority of those working in war industries, chose to collaborate with the committees for industrial mobilization rather than to fight them. They did this because it allowed the union leaders to have more of a say in the management of production during the war, but it also opened up a huge amount of discontent amongst rank and file workers. So to create a pressure valve for discontent, the union leaders encouraged the spreading of what they called internal commissions. These were bodies kind of similar to shop stewards committees in Australia or in Britain, where bodies made up of leading representatives of the class could represent grievances of workers to management. Initially, these internal commissions were relatively controlled by the union officials. So what they would do at meetings of workers is they would put up a union list of five people for the internal commission, which they would try to get the rank and file to just rubber stamp. But they also had their kind of own formal independent life as well, which meant that they could start to become a conduit for rank and file organising against the collaboration of the trade union officials. And I'll come back to that because those internal commissions are a really important key to the development of the factory councils. For the political organisations of the working class in Italy, obviously the war was a major test. The Italian Socialist Party, which was the largest and the most prestigious organisation on the left, refused to join other parties of the Second International in supporting the war. But the leadership took a fundamentally passive approach, which was summed up by their slogan, neither support nor sabotage, which means we won't actively mobilise workers to fight at the front, but we also won't disrupt war production through strikes, riots and mobilisations. This position, I think, was mostly calculated to try to stall a confrontation in the party, which is increasingly divided between a reformist and a revolutionary wing. So the openly reformist wing of the Italian Socialist Party was led by Filippo Turati. Numerically in the party, they were quite a small minority, but they controlled some very important and key institutions in the party and in Italian society. So they ran the trade unions. They had 52 elected deputies in the Italian parliament. They ran all of the town councils. And that meant that they had a political influence that was disproportionate to their actual support. There was another faction that are known as the Maximalists, led by Sarati, and they dominated the leadership of the party, its national executive. Sarati's group criticised the reformists from an apparently kind of radical Marxist position. But if you look beyond, and this is, you know, the documents are a real testament to this, I think, if you look beyond their radical verbiage, which really defined the tendency, they usually failed to distinguish themselves from the reformists in practice, pouring endless energy into election campaigns and agitation for democratic reforms. The question of socialism was essentially put on the back burner as a question for the future. So this faction would later be identified as centrist by the communists in the PSI for Sarati's kind of unwavering commitment to unity of the party between reformists and revolutionaries. Lastly, there was a very quite strong and important revolutionary wing of the party centred around Amadeo Bordiga, a young radical from Naples. And Bordiga's hostility to the reformists in the party and his opposition to Italian imperialism gave him a lot of credibility, particularly amongst the youth of the party. And he was a key figure that cohered opposition to their class collaborationist policies. But he was much more effective, and this will be an important ingredient in the way the debates play out, at denouncing reformism in the PSI than he was actually building a revolutionary leadership out of the existing struggles of workers. So how did the councils emerge? Well, calls for the creation of Soviets in Italy on the model of what had happened in Russia in 1917 was becoming very widespread on the left in Italy by early 1919. So Giovanni Boero, who was the secretary of the Turin section of the Socialist Party, called for their creation in March of 1919. Alfonso Leonetti, who wrote for the paper of the youth wing of the party, wrote that the creation of Soviets was the surest guarantee of the movement towards socialism. So this was actually a relatively widespread view, but the question was how to move from that aspiration to a practical program. I think it's useful to compare how the councils emerged in Russia to the classic account of how Soviets emerged in Russia, which comes from Trotsky's history. In Russia, Trotsky wrote, "The Soviet came into being as a response to an objective need, a need born of the course of events. It was an organisation which was authoritative and yet had no traditions, which could immediately involve the scattered mass of hundreds of thousands of people while having virtually no organised machinery, which united the revolutionary currents within the proletariat, which was capable of initiative and spontaneous self-control, and most important of all, which could be brought out from underground within 24 hours. So the situation in Italy was very different to this. In Russia, factory organisation and trade unions were continually suppressed. So when workers were finally, after the February Revolution in 1917, able to organise legally, they improvised Soviets as a radically democratic institution within 24 hours. In Western Europe, and this counts for Italy, there were strong traditions of trade unionism and large legal workers' parties. So the process of the emergence of workers' councils was much more painstaking, as radicalising workers attempted to find a way to break out of the shackles that were imposed by the trade union bureaucracy, and which, you know, favoured containment and class collaboration and find a way to organise themselves. So the internal commissions that I mentioned before became the focal point for the attempt to build Soviets in Russia, and it's from their structures that the factory councils would emerge. Most accounts, I'm sure people have read about this before, I think, present the idea that the notion that the internal commissions would be the embryo of Soviets as Gramsci's unique genius insight. And I think this is wrong. Actually, by the beginning of 1919 in Italy, the internal commissions were the subject of debate by the entire organized working class in the north. Everybody was debating out what role they could play in the struggle. So the reformist wing of the PSI wanted them to be permanent organizations for class collaboration. They dreamed of a kind of pluralist democracy where workers' organizations would have a seat at the table in a permanent space in Italian political life. On the radical left, there are a wide variety of different schemes for the internal commissions. So some of the anarchists wanted them to be rival organizations to the unions, which they saw as bureaucratic and irreformable. While revolutionary Marxists were becoming more attuned to the idea that they could become a basis for working class political power. And so there was a Polish technician, Aaron Mitzner, who was a follower of Rosa Luxemburg, actually, who was one of the first people to start talking about the internal commissions as the basis of building Soviets as early as 1917. And his conversations with Gramsci influenced Gramsci's position greatly. Undoubtedly, though, Gramsci played a really key role in motivating the formation of the councils and giving them a systematic worldview and a strategy. So Gramsci's vision was based on a reading of Lenin's State and Revolution, which had been recently translated, and also studying the practical experience of the British shop stewards movement, the Hungarian and German revolutions, and the rest of the Europe-wide revolutionary wave. The first time his argument was launched publicly was in the article Proletarian Democracy, which was published in his journal Ordine Nuovo in June of 1919. And Gramsci outlined a political strategy for the creation of Soviets, had a couple of key elements. Firstly, he argued the traditional institutions of the workers' movement weren't up to the task of leading the workers' movement to power. The unions were restricted to negotiating the value of labour power, and the Socialist Party was incapable of organising the whole of the working class, because to do so would mean abandoning its historic task of cohering the vanguard, the most politically conscious workers. And both institutions, furthermore, bore the mark of their origins in stable capitalist society. They'd become trapped within the logic of capitalism, which imparted a particularly conservative character on their leaderships. Secondly, he said, while the power of the capitalist class lay in their control over finance, the centre of working class power was the factory, which Gramsci described as the national territory of the working class. So organising the factory was a precondition for working class political power. After the experience of self-management, workers could begin to conceive society, as he said, as one immense factory organised with the same precision, method and order. Lastly, a new institution was necessary, modelled on the Russian Soviets, which could educate and lead the working class to seize power. The internal commissions had the potential to become this institution, but only if they broadened out their role to organise all workers and deepened their function in society to prepare the working class to rule. So Gramsci's proposals in Ordine Nuovo had a really electrifying impact on the working class. In August of 1919, the workers at Fiat Centro, the largest factory in the country, dissolved their internal commission and called for an election of a council from everyone in the workforce. Workers at Fiat Brevetti, another auto factory, developed a model that would be followed everywhere, where only union members would be able to stand for election in the councils, but workers everywhere would be given a vote. The councils were independent of the official union structures, and they aspired to embrace first the entirety of the Turin working class and then to spread nationally and create a national structure of workers' power. By October, there were more than 50,000 organised in the workers' councils in Turin, and by the end of the year, more than 150,000. At the end of October in 1919, the first General Assembly of the factory councils drew up a programme. And the programme declared itself, it had quite radical aspirations, an exposition of the concepts which underpin the rise of a new form of proletarian power. Its purpose is to train in Italy a practical experiment in the achievement of communist society. And the task of the deputies, the delegates from the councils, was drawn up in this document, and they fell broadly into three categories: the defence of the rights of workers, education, and the preparation for seizure of power in the factories. That's the good news. The bad news. The councils drew into action the vanguard of the working class in the north, and their program reflected the radicalization and high aspirations that workers had achieved. But the councils never really reached the level of asserting an alternative authority to the capitalist state in Italy. I think there were two main limitations to this. The first is that they remained largely restricted to the task of asserting control over production on the factory floor. But while private property remained in the hands of the capitalist class, and they controlled the state, it was impossible for workers to liberate themselves completely in the factories. The council form had to be extended, like the Soviets in Russia, to encompass political as well as industrial organisation. And attempting to assert control over production could assert, I think, contradictory pressures on workers. on the one hand, it could advance the struggle by impressing on them the need to take more and more of society under their own control. On the other hand, it could lead workers down the kind of dead-end path of advising management, who, remember, was still in power, on how to improve production. So this danger was evident in Italy when the bosses at Fiat demanded that productivity be increased to match the standards that were being achieved in American auto factories. The rank-and-file workers in the auto factories obviously instinctively rejected these proposals as an intensification of exploitation. But they were calmed down by Boero and Guarino, two leaders of the factory councils. Boero and Guarino argued that the power of the working class grew from their mastery over production, and so they couldn't refuse attempts to increase output and productivity. But with council, even with councils running the factory floor, any increase in productivity would still just flow to the bosses, obviously, in the form of increased profits. So as it stood, these council leaders were unwittingly holding back an incipient strike movement against capitalist profiteering. The intervention of Gramsci's group, the L'Ordine Nuovo group, actually acted to reinforce this illusion. I think this is one of the biggest problems, which motivated people like Boero and Guarino, that controlling production was enough to confront the capitalist class and the state. So they wrote in L'Ordine Nuovo, "The working masses must take adequate steps to acquire complete self-government. And the first step along this road consists in disciplining themselves inside the workshop. Nor can it be denied that the discipline which will be established along with the new system will lead to an improvement in production. So to those who object that by this method we are collaborating with our opponents, with the owners of the factory, we reply that on the contrary, this is only the means of letting them know in concrete terms that the end of their domination is at hand." So I think a very mistaken conception of what it means to challenge the capitalist class for power. Secondly, with few exceptions, the councils never became generalized outside of the big metalworks in Turin. Only Turin, was known as the Italian Petrograd, the biggest industrial city in the country, had both the large productive units and the traditions of organized independent rank and file activity to encourage a council project process. So to move from factory organization eventually to workers' councils that could actually embrace the whole country, you needed more than Gramsci's radical ideas. You needed a strategy that could transcend the particular geographical and political boundaries of Turin and develop a strategy that could embrace the entire working class nationally. So there was a huge gap, tragically, between the struggle in the northern factories and the social turmoil that was sweeping the rest of the country. It's important to remember at this time, peasant land occupations were sweeping the south, fascist gangs were roaming the countryside and making their first attacks on Socialist Party headquarters. So the Italian councils, I think, were essentially, to summarize it, were hobbled by their economism, which is the fact that they were limited to the supervision of production, and their sectionalism, their inability to reach beyond the big battalions of the working class in the north. So unable to drive the situation forward, the councils actually stagnated quite quickly, to be kind of realistic about their role. By early 1920, they were running out of things to do, and the anarchist Guarino, who was one of the most fervent advocates of the council movement, admitted that beyond their role in organizing big citywide demonstrations, which was a very important thing that the councils did, they were failing to find new things to do that went beyond the role of the old internal commissions, supervising production, raising grievances with management, all that sort of stuff. So this impasse in the council movement brought the question of political organization to the fore. Nobody could ignore it anymore. Only an organized revolutionary party could intervene to overcome the limitations of these councils and pose a direct challenge to the trade union bureaucracy and parliamentarians. At the Bologna conference of the Socialist Party in 1919, there were promising signs. The party actually voted to pledge itself to the revolutionary overthrow of capitalism. But obviously, the test of politics is not the kind of rhetoric or lofty resolutions that are passed at party conferences, but practice. And in practice, the dominant factions of the PSI recoiled in total horror at the council movement. So Turati's reformist wing of the party saw correctly the potential for the councils to pose a challenge to the trade union bureaucracy and was horrified by it. Sarati's maximalists hated the idea that non-union workers, workers who weren't organized, were given the right to vote and derided the councils as anarchism. As an alternative to this movement based on the real struggles of workers trying to figure out a political form for their own emancipation, the PSI leaders held a national council meeting in January of 1920 in which the maximalists drew up elaborate blueprints for the creation of Soviets and workers' councils that they said they would implement upon, a revolution once that had been secured, a completely legalistic and abstract conception of what it means to build workers' power. Bordiger, by this point, was the undisputed leader of the different communist groupings in the PSI, which will mostly cohere through his newspaper, which is called Il Soviet. So it gives you an idea that workers' councils was something that he was meant to be for as well. This meant he had an enormous amount of responsibility to give a lead to the council movement and fight to cohere, you know, the revolutionary elements within it. But instead, Bordiger actually disavowed the councils. He based his hostility to the movement on the idea that workers' control of production was a reformist illusion so long as the capitalist state prevailed. In a sense, I think Bordiger correctly identified some of the limitations of the council movement. If the councils didn't fight for political power, they wouldn't be able to exercise true economic power in the workplace. But Bordiger made no argument for providing revolutionary leadership to the movement that had already developed in order to advance it and clarify its politics. Instead of workers' power emerging organically through working class struggle, Bordiger thought that the institutions of working class government would be decreed from above after the Communist Party's victory. So he wrote in his paper, "Tomorrow's Soviets will have their genesis in the local sections of the Communist Party. These sections should make ready the elements that immediately after revolutionary victory be offered to the vote of the proletarian electoral mass in order to create the local delegate councils." So people will notice this is a mirror image of the politics of the maximalists, who also gave lip service to the councils and saw them as a sterile abstraction to be imposed from above outside of the reality of living working class struggle. And one thing this reflects, I think, is that Bordiger actually shared with Sarardi and Tarardi and the mainstream of the Socialist Party the fundamental assumption of Second International Marxism, which is that the rule of the working class meant the rule of the party, and that the fight for socialism was preordained by mechanical historical factors and there was no real role for conscious political intervention. Bordiger's attempt to apply what he understood as Leninism, the kind of lessons of the Bolshevik Party in Russia, relied almost exclusively on campaigning inside the PSI to rectify its reformist errors and turn it into a genuine communist party. He had no strategy and orientation to forces outside of the party. I think this reflected the difference in Bordiger and Gramsci's conceptions of the revolutionary process. I think this is actually well summed up by Togliatti, one of Gramsci's close collaborators in this period. Later, a bit more of a shady history, but that's a different story. And he summarized the debate basically in this way. He said, Bordiger believed that the party would base itself on foreseeing a future moment when it would be called upon to lead the working class in the final assault for the conquest of power, whereas Gramsci thought that the role of the party was to accompany the working class through all the intermediate stages of struggle that it goes through. I think Gramsci's great strength in his conception of the councils was his drive to relate the goal of working class political power to the real movement of workers in struggle. But his attempt to learn the lessons of the Russian Revolution was almost in some ways as one-sided as Bordiger's. He's heavily influenced by the French syndicalists that he read and he got most of his coverage of the Russian Revolution from. And Gramsci saw the development of a council theory of workers' revolution as expressed in Lenin's State and Revolution as the main contribution of the Bolsheviks to the lessons and tradition of the revolutionary left. So he neglected the other key lesson, I think, that came out of the Russian Revolution, which was the need to build a mass interventionist revolutionary workers' party to advance the process of self-organization in the councils and lead them to victory. In his first articles on the factory councils, Gramsci posed the workers' councils as the force that would rejuvenate the Socialist Party, shake it out of its kind of bureaucratic inertia and transform it into a genuine revolutionary party. I think this was a fatal error. The appearance of workers' councils in a kind of historical period of hardened struggle doesn't in itself solve the questions of revolutionary organization. It only poses them more sharply and the need to combat reformist political forces, to break the stranglehold of the trade union bureaucracy and parliamentarians over the movement. So Gramsci was forced to grapple with the party question eventually, but it was only defensively after the councils had come under attack from all sorts of forces in the PSI and had reached a point of crisis. In January of 1920, Gramsci was calling for a renewal of the Socialist Party. By March, he had actually drawn closer to the local supporters of Bordiger in Turin, who were less sectarian than their national representative and supported the council movement. And together they drafted an action program, which outlined two key tasks. One was solving the problem of arming the proletariat, and two was arousing through the province a powerful class movement of poor peasants and smallholders in solidarity with the industrial movement. So these were worthwhile and accurate goals, I think. But tragically, Gramsci and his collaborators in Turin were grasping towards a solution to the problems of the councils, just as the ruling class in Italy were gearing up for a series of major confrontations to defeat them. And so there would be little kind of opportunity for them to put this perspective to the test. So in April of 1920, Turinese workers were locked out by their employers. It began as a pretty small dispute over the implementation of daylight savings time in the factory, something that was very, very unpopular then amongst some sections of society is now. But it spiraled into a dispute which led the metalworks bosses to demand the complete dissolution of the councils. At that point, workers had no choice faced with the kind of aggressiveness of the employers, but to generalise the struggle, and they sparked a general strike, which brought out 500,000 workers in Turin and drew millions behind it. But while the strikers fought bitterly to defend the councils, the Socialist Party newspaper Avanti refused to print their appeals for assistance from the rest of the country. Turin was surrounded by, 50,000 troops, a whole bunch of cannons, but in the end, the ruling class didn't even need to open fire on the general strike. Its isolation alone was enough to lead workers to return to work demoralised after a month of struggle. So it's saying the anarcho-syndicalists, who are, I think, really should be focused on more in the histories because they're an important piece of the puzzle in understanding the development of a revolutionary left in this period. Mostly they were outside of the Socialist Party and they played a really important role both in the councils and in the April general strike. They led successful strikes when April was happening to shut down railways and ports that were transporting troops to crush the struggle. They issued pretty clear national appeals in a way that the Socialist Party didn't, saying, don't let the army converge on Turin. Don't be accomplices to a massacre. But the anarcho-syndicalists, while the thing that they got right was the need to tenaciously throw themselves into struggle, their politics were limited as well. Militant action by a minority was not enough to win. And their reliance, which I think is a key part of their politics, on being part of sporadic insurrectionary uprisings to build their forces, had no orientation or viable long-term strategy for building organisation to combat the influence of reformism within the working class. So the defeat of the April strike was a decisive test for the council movement, which I think it's worth saying it failed. After return to work, the councils were severely limited in their functioning. They were no longer allowed to meet during work hours and were kind of circumscribed. And the council commissars, people who led them, were quite discredited for their inability to lead the struggle to success. The occupations of the factories in September of 1920 is often celebrated as the high point of the Biennio Rosso, and people should read Paolo Spriano's really beautiful book on this if they want to learn more. But I think it's worth saying that in many ways, by September of 1920, the die had been cast. The heroic struggle in September, which saw workers arm themselves and take control of their workplaces, was again isolated. It was a kind of last gasp of the movement. The ruling class adopted a strategy of waiting the occupations out, not even moving troops in, but gambling that the PSI and the reformist trade union leaders would contain the struggle. And this gamble paid off, as the reformist forces traded away the occupations in favour of vague promises from the government that workers would be allowed more participation in management. So by November, after the defeat of the councils, it was pretty clear that the working class had suffered a fatal blow in Italy. A wave of fascist terror, as soon as the occupations ended, began to sweep the country, and the capitalist class went on the offensive against the unions. By 1921, union membership had halved. By 1922, Mussolini had come to power. By 1926, of course, the entirety of the organisations of the working class and the left had been banned and driven into an underground existence. So the capitalist class were able to weather the two red years. So what lessons can we draw from this? The most important one, I think, is obviously that the defeat, the most important lesson was that the necessity for a revolutionary party to lead the workers' movement to victory. The councils in themselves and their activity were proof of an essential claim of Marxism, I think. The capacity of working class self-organisation to point the way to a liberated society. But permanently defeating the organised capitalist class and their state is another matter. Without a revolutionary party capable of pushing past moments of hesitation, generalising struggle across different geographical boundaries and challenging forces which ultimately want to contain it, the councils were never going to reach their full political potential. Gramsci, unfortunately, the clearest, I think, in a lot of ways, revolutionary of this period, remained a captive of the PSI's Socialist Party's reformist majority. He didn't build a revolutionary faction that could lead a split in the party and cohere something new until it was too late. If Gramsci had attempted to more seriously gather forces around a revolutionary perspective, I think it would have been possible to win support on a wider scale from radicals both within and outside of the Socialist Party. So one great missed opportunity that goes unexplored often is Gramsci's relationship with the anarcho-syndicalists. Gramsci was highly respected by these people because they were some of the most fervent advocates of the council movement. But virtually none of them out of this defeat were won to the political project of forming a communist party. A couple of reasons for this. I think Gramsci was hamstrung by a sectarian attitude when it came to engaging them in ideological debates. I think this was inherited from the reformist tradition of the Socialist Party, which he developed criticisms of too late, which saw the anarchists purely as ultra-left wreckers, when in reality, they were misguided but very often well-intentioned militants who could have been argued with and reasoned with. to get a sense of the tone that Gramsci struck when engaging in polemics with the anarchists, you just have to read the first sentence of his address to the anarchists, the first attempt that he made to make a systematic statement. The first sentence, and this was published on the eve of the April strike when the anarcho-syndicals were actually moving into action to support the general strike. And Gramsci starts the article by saying, "The Italian anarchists are very touchy as well as arrogant." So, probably not good. Another limiting factor is that Gramsci's politics in the early period of the council movement were actually incredibly close to the anarcho-syndicalists, despite his sectarian. So when this was, he shared the kind of illusion that workplace economic organization could build on its own a challenge to the capitalist class and their state. And this irony didn't go unnoticed, Gramsci's theoretical softness on these people and his political sectarianism. When a member of Gramsci's L'Ordine Nuovo group was invited to attend a conference of the syndicalists as an observer, one of the syndicalists asked this representative, basically, "Why do you scorn us so much in our paper while you praise to the stars the IWW in America, which have basically exactly the same politics as us?" And obviously they didn't have a good answer to that question. Inside the Turin section of the Socialist Party, Gramsci's grouping had some success in influencing the followers of Bordiga and drawing them into work in the councils, essentially in defiance of Bordiga's perspective. But nationally, they had no presence, so couldn't play a role. When revolutionaries finally walked out of the Socialist Party in January of 1921, they paid a pretty heavy price for their disorganisation. The lack of preparatory work to organise opposition to the reformist leadership of the party meant they left with a minority of the PSI's members. And politically, their new party was dominated by Bordiga and shaped by his abstentionist sectarian attitude. The second most important lesson, I think, is a point that was initially neglected by Gramsci, Bordiga, the anarchists, pretty much everybody, which is that to rally the social forces necessary to challenge capitalism, workers in Italy needed to build institutions capable of taking up the demands of all other oppressed social groups. The ability of the Soviets in Russia, in contrast, to act as a political tribune of the oppressed, not just as economic, institutions to control the factories, but bodies that could draft up resolutions and take action to solve problems in the military, the question of land for the peasants, the question of national minorities, was key to the success of that revolution. And that political approach allowed workers' councils to win the majority of mutinying soldiers, rebellious peasants, and religious and national minorities, building a coalition under the leadership of revolutionary workers that was able to destroy the capitalist state for the first time in human history. The maximalist leadership of the Socialist Party was a positive obstacle to this project in Italy. One example, in Trapani, 1920, when 150,000 peasants struck, not a single Socialist Party deputy was sent to offer support to their struggle. And the suspicion of the maximalists towards the peasants' movement was indicated by Sarardi, who said, "Everybody knows that the movement for the occupation of the lands was a demagogic and petty bourgeois movement aimed at entrancing the agricultural masses." But Gramsci clearly was weak on this question as well. When Gramsci's error, I think, essentially was that he viewed the factories in Italy as the national territory of the working class, as I referenced earlier, when actually the national territory for the working class in any struggle for power is the national territory itself. Their ability to win relies on their ability to raise the demands of all oppressed social layers and solve all problems of national political life. So Gramsci viewed the factories in the north of Italy as essentially a microcosm of Italian capitalist society, that they were, in a sense, an embryo of the institutions that needed to be organised, but he ignored the vast gulf outside of that of all the other questions that needed to be solved. In the aftermath of Gramsci's defeat, this question came to occupy him a lot, and I think his essay on the Southern Question, written in 1926, which urged the working class to forge an alliance with impoverished peasants, was, I think, a kind of theoretical culmination of these lessons. And if people are familiar with Gramsci's prison notebooks, which I'm not going to talk about, obviously, a lot of the lessons of the factory councils are kind of scattered through the notes that he wrote over a decade in imprisonment after he was jailed by the fascists in 1926. So to sum it up in like maybe something pithy or whatever, I think the key thing that comes out of Italy 1919 to 1920 is kind of what was proved in Italy in the negative was what was proved in the positive in Russia, which is the need to organize around advancing politicized class struggle to the point of building institutions that are capable of providing not just a challenge to the economic power of the capitalist class in the factory, but a political challenge to the state as well. And yeah, I'll leave it there. Cool. Well, I quite deliberately left out of the introduction all the stories of militancy and cool stuff that happened in Italy in this period. So, number one, obviously, sorry if you got bored out of your brains during the talk. But two, like, it's important to go over it a little bit because I think if you look at the narrative, you look at what happened in the couple of decades preceding this, it shows the possibility and it teaches you a few important lessons. Like, think about it, in what country, within a week of World War I breaking out in Italy, there was an insurrection in Ancona. The country hadn't even entered the war, but that was the level of kind of anti-militarist and radical traditions that existed. There's the April, 1917, August general strike where workers initially strike over bread lines and they shut factories down in Turin. When the bosses quickly arranged for bread to be delivered in truckloads to the factory, they pause momentarily. They turn to each other and they say, well, we don't care about bread. We want to bring down the war and smash the capitalist state. So I think one of the most extreme examples of militancy, class consciousness, internationalists and radical traditions within the working class. But it proves that those sorts of rudimentary struggles and that rudimentary consciousness on its own isn't enough to lead the working class to a conquest of power. Like, you can have the most militant insurrectionary radical working class in the world. It's not enough to destroy the capitalist state. At the moment, the last few years, there's been a lot of centenaries of communist parties forming all across the world. This year was actually the centenary of the Italian Communist Party. And one of the lessons I think that comes out of communist parties being formed in, 1919, 1920, 1921, trying to assimilate the kind of lessons of the Russian Revolution is they come up against this obstacle that in a lot of countries, and this applies to Italy, I think, there's two dominant traditions on the revolutionary left and ways of understanding politics. One is spontaneism, that the way that you change things is just throwing yourself into every single struggle that exists and being the most militant. And the other is a kind of sectarian propagandism. So you can see that in spades in Italy. Just like you look at the syndicalists, they led radical insurrectionary strike after insurrectionary strike all the time in the lead up to the Biennio Rosso. In 1912, there's this strike where the metal workers win a contract where they get the 8-hour day. But as a concession, the union leaders sign away this right that they'd had for years that they can leave 10 minutes early if they want to. And the workers are so incensed by this idea that this customary right is being taken away from them that all the unionized workers that sign onto the agreement go back to work, but all the non-unionized workers go out with the anarcho-syndicalists on a strike that lasts for 2 months. Like, it's just, it's time and time again this happens, but those politics aren't enough. And that's reflected in Gramsci's politics as well. So I think it was Priya mentioned the really important example of the April general strike, really, which posed the strategic questions the most sharply for the workers' movement of any moment in this period. The political response of the Ordine Nuovo group is to suspend their publication, suspend their political argumentation and criticism, and just go to the factories and be part of the strike to lend a hand as much as possible. It's exactly the same methodology that the syndicalists adopted in this period, which was heroic, but it wasn't enough to counter the political kind of problems that they had to confront. On the other hand, you have the propagandist kind of sectarianism of Bordiga. When the general strike breaks out in April of 1919, Bordiga's response to it is to wait it out, and then when it's defeated, to say, well, this confirms my suspicion about the council movement, and this is why everybody should join my faction in the Socialist Party. The added difficulty, I think, beyond just the general question of like trying to assimilate the lessons from Russia, is that there was something that you couldn't learn just from, even if you could perfectly observe the Russian Revolution, speak to Lenin and Trotsky and Kolontai and all these people, which is that Russia didn't provide a model for how to combat, in some ways, the influence of reformism within the working class. The question just wasn't confronted there. And so nobody in Italy had a strategy for that. I think, in a sense, that meant that the defeat in Italy was relatively inevitable, that it had to be just like the German Revolution, a historical experience that workers went through to generalize that lesson. But the biggest problem is that when the Communist Party is founded in 1921, they don't draw any of the right lessons from the factory occupations. They draw the polar opposite of the lessons that they should have drawn. So the party is constructed on a sectarian propagandist model, built on Bordiga's politics. And Gramsci is a part of that process as well. One thing it teaches us, I think, is that if you don't settle your scores with reformism and you don't develop a critique and an organizational response to it early, then the other kind of problem you can fall prey to is ultra-leftism and sectarianism. And so all the left of the Socialist Party that go on to form the Communist Party, they're so burned and traumatized by their experience of being sold out by the maximalists that they become the biggest sectarians on the planet. And if you read some stuff that Gramsci wrote at the end of 1920, yeah, he makes Bordiga look like a real puppy dog in a lot of ways in the way that he writes about these people. So you have this Communist Party that's finally formed, but it has no strategy for how do we win over the tens of thousands of workers that are still members of the Socialist Party? How do we launch united struggles against the threat of fascism with these people? And so in a lot of ways, the formation of the Communist Party is abortive. It's very, very quickly crushed and repressed. And when it's reconstructed on a Stalinist basis and plays a reactionary role in politics for the next several decades of Italian politics. So that's another lesson we need to draw today. Otherwise, this stuff will have all been a total waste. Vince everyone. That's it. Yeah.